Great.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, hello. Welcome. The idea here, in the past I've run various film series, film religion and film specifically, seminar series in Cambridge and in Oxford. And the Cambridge Divinity Faculty particularly has been running religion and film seminars for quite a long time, and they've been very popular. I think partly because everyone loves film, but also because everyone in film loves to deal with religious themes. It's always a great thing to do narrative analysis with. It's always a great thing to do value analysis in film with. So it's always been very popular up to now, naturally. But I wanted to start trying to do them here. Oxford, unlike a lot of other universities, doesn't have colleges running film nights regularly, certainly doesn't popularise them to the university at large, has a great independent, quite a decent independent cinema, but is not hugely film-minded, and it's not particularly media studies university either, of course. But I think there's a lot to be said, and particularly with regard to religion and film. I wanted to do this partly because I do think if you're in religious studies trying to talk about modern religion, what are your texts? Because for most people in the modern world, there isn't, for many people there isn't a religion, and for many of those even who are religious, there isn't a text that they refer to in their daily lives. Where we do our ethics, where we do our ethics in the larger sense, where we do our value research, and where we explore the logic of our values tends, I think, to be in the media as the text that we have. And I feel that film particularly is a really good place to look at these developments and changes and to watch the logic of the public happening as it works itself out. So, you know, existential issues, religious issues, they come together in these things. So that's that. And next week, just briefly, next week, Walter Rombrust, who's head of the Middle East Centre, and works in Egyptian cinema, we'll be talking about Islamic cinema and how that has developed itself as a genre, and also how that genre has then of course been appropriated by the political powers that be. And then we have George Patterson, who will talk about the priest in film. George is a great fan of Tarkovsky and himself wrote a screenplay which he refuses to let me read. And finally, we'll have Jessica Hines, who was the official biographer of Amitabh Bachchan, and is still a great friend of his and a biographer of his. And she's supposed to talk about Bollywood heroes and portrayals of religious duty and affiliation. But this one is The Rise of Buddhism in Hollywood. So, to begin with, as I said, it's not about the ethnography of Buddhism in Hollywood, because I don't think there is very much. There have been a few attempts to educate Americans through film, and perhaps Kundun, I think 7 Years in Tibet was a film where Brad Pitt goes as this jolly, I think he's an Austrian hero, to Tibet, meets the young Dalai Lama, and they play football and they watch movies, and there's a certain amount of East meets West in there, but really Little Buddha, the Bertolucci film, and Kundun, the Scorsese film, are, I think, if anyone can think of others, then please let me know, but are the main texts in Hollywood about Buddhism. And of those two, Kundun is extremely political, more, I think, in many respects than religious. I don't know if either of you have seen it, but it's a film. When I went to get out these films, the young man there said, all I know about Buddhism is Kundun. And it's a film in which Scorsese... Hello.
Hello.
Buddhism in Hollywood?
Yes.
Oh, good. Sit down.
Well, there'll be around a bigger crowd than this. It's such an interesting topic.
It's a quiet crowd, unfortunately. I think we clash with a number of other seminars. But call it a small, friendly seminar.
Yes.
I think Kundun is a film which Scorsese wrote and made as a political move, and I'll come back to this later, but it was very much Scorsese deciding to show people the glory of Tibet. And in it you see monks making mandalas on the floor and how beautiful these mandalas are, and you see the beauties of the Himalayas and you see the beauties of Asian costume, and you go on in this way for quite a long time, but there's relatively little of any Buddhist matter in there, and it rapidly goes on to the idea that this is a charming, peaceful, orientalistic, utopian civilization which the evil oppressors, i.e. the Chinese, are now destroying, and this is good for Americans to hear because an American likes the Chinese from a political perspective. So that was a very political thread which is in Hollywood and which continues to some extent. And Little Buddha, which possibly neither of you have seen, is an interesting film. Bernardo Bertolucci was not himself a Buddhist, but is an interesting thinker and always looking for new things. In any case, he wanted to do a film of the life of Buddha, very simple, a biography. You know, he didn't want anything really Hollywood about it. But backers, of course, insisted on various things, and it became a film about a nice American blonde boy from Seattle who's chosen to be, who might be the new incarnation of a Lama. And he gets taken to India, and Bridget Fonda, who's a very bankable star at that time, follows him, and they have lots of little lessons about Buddhism. And interspersed through this are scenes in which, from the pale, unsatisfying, bluish-white interiors of Seattle, it suddenly shoots to the gold and red-coloured exteriors of India. This was the first film to be filmed in Bhutan, so some of it in India, some in Bhutan, where Keanu Reeves is looking particularly buff and walks around as young Prince Siddhartha and goes through various things. And, and there is a great educational content to it. He says a lot, which comes from Hermann Hesse, really, more, I think, than anything else. But it was seen as, for many Americans, as an education in Buddhism. And almost universally, the comments on that film, which went up for Oscars, so it did have this Hollywood audience, was Americans going, oh, I thought the Seattle stuff with the Americans was really boring, but I wish it was just more of Keanu Reeves. And the Buddha, and that was really wonderful. So it was very successful as an Orientalist education in Buddhism, but not really an ethnography. So those I'm putting aside, this is really part of a larger project that I'm interested in, which is about postmodernism to some extent, whatever it is. Did it, such as it was, did it ever reach the public? Such as it is, has it reached the public, and have we gone beyond it? Was postmodernism a straw man all along? Did it trickle down into the public consciousness from the academic sphere in which we move? And postmodernism being many things, being about textual methodology. I'll give what I've got here as a summary of it. But postmodernism being something in sociology, something in hermeneutic methodology throughout the humanities, and also a more philosophical, a methodological position about the grand narratives of doing any kind of study, and also a deeper philosophical perspective on what all of these things mean. Did any of this get to the public consciousness? Was it one rarefied symptom of something, a movement which has flowed through the public consciousness in any case? And if it has been a reality of modern life, what form has it taken in public, and what have been the consequences? What has happened to postmodernism, which peaked in many respects in the 90s, and now we've moved beyond, to some extent, that enthusiasm for those insights? So I've given my own summary of postmodernism, which I'm forever having to do to people, and then they argue or they don't argue, but I've summarized it in this way. Skepticism towards grand narratives. That was Lyotard, wasn't it, who said that, I think. Which is right. So that's grand narratives of interpretation, grand narratives of metaphysics, which comes into this paper. But also I've added the idea that this has to yield to new narratives. What we had in old postmodernism was the idea that you just deconstructed everything and then left it there. But what, of course, happens in reality is that you deconstruct and then you reconstruct. Just in the way that I think people read Derrida less and less, we have a kind of global constructionist project going on. That's my argument in many ways. Undermining traditional attachments for a wider and more diverse range of interests. That's the idea on the negative side, that of course we've lost our roots, and now we have no roots and we float about, but we move more, we see more. So everything has become shallower and yet broader. That's been seen as a criticism. In the global context, it's also seen as a positive feature of postmodernism in as it really exists. Most of us don't spend quite so much time with our families as people did 20 years ago, but we travel a lot and we have perhaps a broader identity. And of course this ties into issues of truth and issues of ethics and issues of religion. So perhaps one of the best arguments you can make for the idea that postmodernism has reached the people is that fewer and fewer of us go to church and fewer of us are clear about how we fill in that box on the census form. You can put that down to many things, but I think that ties in very well with the idea that for cultural reasons and also for reasons that are to do with the intersection of science and truth and belief and authority, those things at the heart of the philosophical project of postmodernism, those have really come to bear on what people actually believe. And as a third point in postmodernism, I put that it's something that once you get your head around it, it's supposed to have a certain thoroughgoing integrity such that you see it in your own life, you see it psychologically, you see it culturally, you see it politically, you see it at some deeper dimension that's to do with perception and reality itself. So it's not just a little theory that floats about on one level, it's supposed to permeate through all these different levels. So the idea is that religion is a particular manifestation of this, and it raises a new issue that I think is very interesting. What is choice? The idea that if we no longer immediately adopt what we are given religiously, that those authorities no longer apply, what does it mean now for us to choose our ethos, our ethics, our belief, and indeed our cultural surroundings now that we can move so much more freely? And is it really choice? That's also arisen more and more in religious studies, the idea that we used to just grow up Christians and be Christians. Now we see lots of cultures around us and learn about them at school, so we have to choose one. But that's a false model. We don't just sit there and go, gosh, I really liked Hinduism when I read about it last week, or I really enjoyed Judaism last term. I choose it now. Obviously, that model is not quite right, and we have to do something. We have to get deeper into what it means for us to choose a religion in the modern world. So, skim through this. There's some debate about whether you can talk about ideology in the culture. What is it to look at, for instance, American mainstream popular ideology? Is there a context in which you can do this? Is that kind of zeitgeist even existent? Well, I'm trying to do this with Hollywood, and I think to some extent it's valid and a useful thing to do. Also, Hollywood, I think, is America's mirror, TV and film. But I feel that TV takes its cue from film more than film takes its cue from TV. That's very arguable. People have a much higher intake of television, but film still has a kind of cultural priority, I think. So it's a great tool for assimilation. If you want to talk about globalism, it's been very important. Film critic Go writes in 1884, and this is about Toronto, famously multicultural community. In less than half a biblical lifetime, Toronto's Italian community has all but completed the transition from ethnic group to mainstream. And what is most fascinating about the transition is that it came about not in a flurry of assimilation, but through a total redefinition of mainstream, a reworking of the criteria that go into making a Torontonian. I think this is very important. Even the current government has this idea of assimilation, where you're going to make everybody go to the same picnic in your local borough, and then they'll all eat each other's tasty foods, and that will do the job. Whereas actually I think you do have to take up the idea of ideology, and ideology as reflection, ideology as identity, because often that's where it's done. You know, you may enjoy someone else's delicious samosa, but until you've seen the film with a woman making a samosa and understand her family and understand the ethos of what she does and where it stands within her life, ideologically much richer, the assimilation is incomplete. So, and again, as part of the setup, I think an important part of doing study of film studies of media studies where you're looking at large-scale narrative, a large-scale text of any kind, is to look at not just the themes, not just the settings, the ethnographic settings of the films, but the structure. The logic of film studies is like the logic of doing narrative theology in the Old Testament. You get standard narrative structures that repeat and repeat and repeat, and you also get subcurrents, just to say the wisdom literature in the Old Testament. Famously, that's sort of Jonah, Job, Jacob, and Joseph as well, particularly take the narrative structures and stand them on their heads and produce kind of almost subcultural currents. People have argued that this indeed does represent a subculture within Israelite religion, in the same way you get this in film. So there's an argument that there's an argument in film studies that Hollywood only reflects the WASPs, the wealthy white males. But I think there's also a strong argument that you see happening now more than ever through independent film and through international film, where actually Hollywood is a very fluid mirror for American society. I think you can make that argument now more than you could 10 years ago, 20 years ago, and before. So suddenly Asian cinema, for instance, has transformed the face of Hollywood, of Hollywood's most characteristic genre, which is the action film, has been completely changed, but deeply changed in its settings, its scenes, and its deep structure. Now, in the classic Hollywood narrative structure, it's very simple. It's like reading Shakespeare. It's order, disruption of order, reconciliation. The central hero character is a hero, experiences a disruption of the order, and manages to restore it. There's usually a love story, but it's very much that arc of return to an initial status. And you can see how people argue that that's fundamentally conservative narrative structure. It's always about threat to the existing authority, and then sorting out that threat. And I think I want to argue that that structure no longer dominates in the way that it used to. It's no longer about threat and return. It's much more... I've got the wrong piece of paper. It's not about threat and restoration of the initial order. It's about flaws in the order, and that disruption is not from an outside agency, which used to be the case. You know, you always had the Indians come and attack you always had the aliens come, you always had some outsider come and attack. Now it's an internal disruption, which leads not to restoration of order, but to either a transformation of the order or to a complete departure, which is totally manic in terms of normal Hollywood narrative structures. You know, you can't have the Indians come along and, in fact, they destroy the settlement village and that's the end of the film. Nor can you have the Indians come along and convert everyone and everyone goes and lives with the Indians. Also something that simply never happens in the whole extraordinary prolific world of Hollywood film. But these things are starting to happen now. I think it's a very striking change. And I really do think it's reflective of a change in the ideology of the culture at large. So I'm going to very briefly... I mean, some of that is also to do with the rise of independent cinema. And there will be whole tomes in Black Girls about independent cinema and how it's transformed America. But independent cinema is traditionally something which has done two things. It's come from within the American ideology structure and subverted it. So classically, it's a critique. It's a critical. It's, you know, it's Frankfurt critical theory goes to work on independent cinema. That works. What happens? The order is disrupted. The hero is upset. Everyone else is upset. And usually either there is disaster. You know, either you do have these odd Peckinpah films where actually everyone dies, or what you have is entrapment. The hero had a glimmer of hope, or at least realized the problems that were inherent in the situation, but actually gets entrapped back in the situation. And this is true of quite a lot of films. I won't go through a list of all the independent films in which this happens, but that's a classic. If you look at 70s, 80s American independent sort of non-mainstream cinema, there's a lot of that frustration, and there's a sad ending. What you do? Has anyone ever seen Close Encounters of the Third Kind? Yeah, no. This was an early Spielberg film. Spielberg is Hollywood mainstream. When he made it, he felt that it was the film that came from his heart before he went on to all these other exciting films. And it's interesting, it's a classic text for film theory because it comes out of the aliens and heroes genre. It's very much the American theme of the middle-class, middle-aged, midlife crisis husband in a very restrictive family setting. Wife doesn't understand him, child making demands, financial pressures, who glimpses liberation or in some way is able to redeem himself. But what's extraordinary about Close Encounters of the Third Kind is that it was one of the first films from within Hollywood to get rid of the whole narrative thing. It shocked people at the time. It was a cult film. People were surprised, confused, shocked by it. The response was huge, precisely because the character at the end, leaves his family, leaves his young son, leaves his wife, leaves his home, gets in the spaceship and goes away with the aliens. You know, and where the aliens are a cipher for the other culture, this is extraordinary. So that was a kind of a pre-echo of things to come. Now, just briefly, a history of Buddhism in American film, so we can get on to the Buddhist bit of things. Buddhism in America has been many things, of course. It's not an easy subject to talk about. It's been many fantasies of American life. It's also been many different immigrant communities. It's been both threatening and violent. Apocalypse Now, you see that in a film called Black Narcissus. You see this terror of the East. It's also, of course, been romanticized, peaceful, other frequently enough. So one of the earliest films to feature anything of Buddhism in it, and one of the very, very popular film, was 1933, I think it is, pre-war fantasy of Shangri-La. It was Lost Horizon by Frank Capra, of course made before the Second World War, just before, very much an escapist fantasy of escaping from the Depression. And Ronald Coleman, who's really the hero of integrity in American film, he's not John Wayne, he's the man who upholds fine principles. Off he goes, ends up in some wonderful Buddhist land where naturally being spiritually enlightened means that you live forever. And it was a hugely successful film, Lost Horizon. It really sort of broke the box office records at that time. Of course, if you look at it now, it's a classic Orientalist fantasy. It sets the whole tone for this. It's not even in the real world. None of the people, of course, in this place are actually Asian. They're all funny people with funny makeup on their eyes and comedy mustaches. It's extremely beautiful all the time. It leads to supernatural virtues. One of the most important things about it, perhaps two themes that we see in it that are very important, is A, that you take the American hero, who is the center of American film, and you save him. The man who saves everybody else gets saved. There aren't many things that can save an American hero. He's on top of everything. You know, what could save Indiana Jones, for instance? Well, only a spiritual saving of some kind. So what you have is Ronald Coleman going with the whole of America behind him in the Depression era, and he's saved spiritually. And he wants to be able to stay there in Shangri-La, but he can't. So that saving, the hero himself being saved, is an important theme. But also the idea that he can't stay. This is another important theme. And it's fundamental, I think. A, it's not a real world, but also in America at that time, you never left America. And you never gave yourself to another community. And if you fall in love with a beautiful Asian girl, you certainly never stay with her. Although, as in South Pacific, you might have a very pleasant fling. It would be lightly alluded to. But you never stay. It's always in this American holiday. And that's important also because for a long, long time, the fantasy of Buddhism in American cinema is always about saving America, It's always about saving America, saving the hero, but it's never really a social critique. It's never activism. It may be a critique, but it's never an active critique. It never suggests that you change things, that you actually make any significant move to deal with what you're dissatisfied in your current order. Jonathan's watching the fish. Yes, the fish aren't part of the paper. So it sets those patterns, that the hero will be saved, and that's very pleasant, but also that the hero can't stay. After the war, the next film that comes up is that I know of is Powell and Pressburger. This isn't Hollywood, although it was popular in Hollywood. It was a British-made film. Powell and Pressburger's Black Narcissus, which is an excellent film in which a bunch of nuns, Anglican nuns, I think, sorry, not Anglican nuns, English nuns, go to the Himalayas to a Buddhist monastery, and they set up a nunnery there. And they all go mad because it's just too hot and heady, and Buddhism's too deep, and the remnants of these profound and strange and difficult things and challenges to their theistic outlook is just too much for them to take, and they literally all go mad. They throw themselves off the mountain. One of them gets all sort of carnally excited, and the rest have to sort of, the remaining ones have to leave in despair. It's actually an extremely beautiful film. It's a film in which they took wonderful images and they coloured them by hand with coloured chalks to create this more than beautiful beauty of the East. That was 1947, so it was just after the war. Partly, I mean, it suggests the idea as well that during the war the East became more frightening. It certainly has that sort of impression afterwards. So the nuns come along, you know, they're already, as it were, already sterile. They become culturally sterile once they enter into the East. So that's all pre-50s, you could argue, pre the largest influx of actual Buddhist immigrants to America. That's all in the realm of fantasy. And it's worth noticing also a third theme there, where Buddhist cultures are always connected with beauty. That's just an Orientalist theme. But particularly with Buddhism, in a way that isn't the case with lots of other religions that you see within a sort of Orientalist context, lots of beauty. And the films themselves are often characterized by very still dynamics, lots of set pieces where you have a large backdrop or you have a particular lovely image that the audience is allowed to soak in at great length. They're slow films, they're meditative, they're highly aesthetic. Post-war culture changes everything historically. It doesn't mean suddenly there are more films with Buddhists or about Buddhists or by Buddhists, but there was a real influx of actual Buddhists to America. In 1951, the American Buddhist Academy is established. In the 1950s, the Buddhist Study Center in Berkeley, where Gary Snyder, Jack Kerouac, Alan Watts started their Dharma study, is set up. And that is in collaboration with Japanese Buddhists, to greater or lesser effect. The idea was to actually have people come over and teach real Buddhism, sort of a new idea. I just want to show a brief clip here from a film that was very much a Hollywood film, a film made by Disney that they crowed about once it received critical acclaim, was a film called Tina. It was the biography of Tina Turner. It's a film that's about Black Americans. Well, no, it's not. It's not a race film. Sorry, it's very much about the American dream of becoming rich and famous. It's very much about the oppression of women and violence towards women. And Tina Turner was very much abused by her husband. But what's interesting in the middle of it is that there is a scene where, as really happened in her life, and this reflects what was going on in the 50s and 60s, Tina Turner is saved from her abusive relationship and is given spiritual renewal and courage to leave it by being converted to Buddhism by a friend. Now, it's kind of interesting. You don't see many conversion scenes of Americans to Buddhism in any films. Usually Americans are very threatened by the idea of any conversion scene. Here we see it, and it's two Black American women in the 60s, even more unheard of. with a particular practical application, but it reflects the idea that actually this is what was happening. You don't see it reflected until much later, but this is the beginning of the divide between what people now talk about American ethnic Buddhism, i.e. Buddhist immigrants from actual Buddhist countries, and new Buddhism, which is the converts. So let's see if we can get this to work. It's worrying. Is Tina Turner coming to visit her friend who knows that she's been being badly abused by her husband? Let me turn this off. It's a shock to people because they didn't know that any Buddhism was coming.
Just a minute.
It's true.
She is a Buddhist.
In a name. What a surprise. Hello, Jackie. I know it's not like me to come by without calling you back. Just really felt like seeing you. It's okay. I'm glad you did. Oh, well, come on in and make yourself at home.
Well, this is a little different.
Yeah, I know. Would you like some tea?
Yeah. Hey, why not?
So how you doing, Anna?
You know, busy as ever. Getting ready to go on tour. 12 cities.
How are you doing?
Hey, you know me. Once I'm on stage, I'm fine.
And when you're not?
Hey. All right, now. See? Now. Ain't no such thing as not being on stage. You ain't on stage? You getting ready to go on stage, huh?
Hey, bitch. Wait a minute, motherfucker. What you doing, huh? What? You making fun of me? Huh? Now, you know.
Impersonating her husband.
Find your ass. See that? Now. That's the shit there that I'm talking about.
Next time, I just might not take your motherfucking ass to the hospital.
Oh, I'm sorry, Ike. Am I late for rehearsal? Bitch! Bitch, you keep me late? You owe me a dinner, my daddy. Jack, what you do? Huh? Jack, what you do? You play that again? You play that again, Jack? Find your ass! Oh, Lord. Clearly, it's like life's mirror. And when you can see yourself clearly, you can change anything. Come on. You want to try it with me?
Namyo. Nam yo renge kyo, 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 nam yo renge kyo.
Namyoho Rengekyo, Namyoho Rengekyo, Namyoho Rengekyo. Namyoho Rengekyo.
So she goes on, and her husband is surprised and shocked and appalled and confused. As far as we can tell, a lot of the white American audience was extremely pleased and inspired, whereas the black American audience was rather confused.
What year
is that? Oh gosh, I've left my filmography in the other room. I think it's 1993. It's a little while ago. Disney were very proud of having made this film later, because they got...
So what's it called again?
It's called Tina, What's Love Got to Do with It?
That's a big song.
Yeah, exactly. Perhaps Disney's pleased, partly because it was a striking and unusual film. It also brought in lots and lots of minorities under one big banner, women, black Americans, and Buddhism. You know, sort of a field day for Disney in many respects. But it was an interesting truth to be told, and as I say, at the beginning, she's thrown out of her gospel church. That is the paradigm of American film, is to be saved by Christianity, but particularly black American culture. You're saved by the church, you know, you pray to God and God saves you, and this is a very different sort of thing. And they emphasize her practice, which is interesting. I think that's still unusual in films with images of Buddhism. They like to show the ideas. Somebody goes, yes, gosh, who am I? Am I? Is this real? This is a film where actually they don't go into that, but they do show her chanting, they do show small signs of what it is to have practice. So it brings out a number of themes. One of them is that Americans respect the idea of discipline in Buddhist practice. It's a shift from authority, where you have the preacher who tells you what to do, and you have a building in which you enter into the sacred space, to a kind of discipline paradigm, which you see reflected again and again and again, where suddenly the individual is liberated from those paradigms of authority in the American idea, of course, because none of these people are going to see any Buddhist community, they're not going to any temple, they're not going to enter a monastery, they're not even talking to other Buddhists in many cases, but they have adopted a discipline, and this is seen as one of the things that the West lacks, and that Buddhism can offer. And that comes up what happens when all of this comes into the mainstream, where it's all about action movies and martial arts. You go from a kind of action hero who bashes people about with a gun or with his fists because he's a real man, to the idea that what you have in almost every action movie that's made now, there's a prolonged period of part spiritual, part psychological discipline. And usually you have some vaguely orientalized tutor of some kind, who indeed gives you not only physical instruction, but much more importantly, some kind of personal instruction. I haven't mentioned, because it's not a film, but the The American TV show where Grasshopper walked through the Old West and did martial arts.
Kung Fu.
Yes, it was actually called Kung Fu. This was a TV show that was made originally for Bruce Lee. And Bruce Lee got to America ready to make this wonderful show that would be about a Chinese man, very able in his martial arts abilities, but also spreading ideas to do with Chinese culture, very Buddhistic ideas of Chinese culture, throughout the Wild West of America. And of course, at the last moment, they didn't give the role to Bruce Lee. He was extremely upset. They gave it to a nice American man and funny eye makeup again. Anyway, it's interesting that that reflects also another theme, which is that Buddhism in film gets connected with the idea of liberation, naturally enough. Liberation of either the middle-class white mainstream American individual from the entrapments of his society, but also, more importantly, in some respects, the liberation of the minority from their situation. You see it again in The Matrix, which is taken as the great Buddhist postmodern text. And in The Matrix, not only do you have those aspects of the film where everyone questions reality, and reality ends up being described in a way that in some respects fits the idea, fits aspects of Buddhist metaphysics, and there are lots of essays on the matrix metaphysics and Yogacara idealism, which are wacky and also have some, they have some purchase, partly because it was modelled specifically on those ideas, not by any fortuitous, profound conceptual reasons. But The Matrix also had a huge theme where throughout, Keanu Reeves, of course, has played the Buddha in one form or another repeatedly. He's with Morpheus, who is Lawrence Fishburne, who's his guru character, and is a black American character. And there are many scenes in which whenever he talks about liberation, we will be free, we will no longer be, he uses words of, we will no longer be bound, we are slaves to these computer robot creatures that have taken us over. We leave that part out. We are slaves and we'll be liberated. And there are scenes where he's shackled with handcuffs behind him and he breaks his shackles in this great sort of a Birth of a Nation-esque image. And also a scene which many people miss where that character is caught by the FBI-like bad guys in The Matrix. And suddenly it switches to an overhead shot of him being beaten with sticks by lots of men in police uniforms, which is a direct reference to the beatings that set off the LA riots in America, where that was precisely the image that was sent around, this black man crouched on the floor being beaten by lots of white men with sticks and police uniforms. So that theme also becomes apparent more and more. And it's interesting, it reflects the reality of what happens historically at this stage, that actually there start to be real Buddhists in America. Not just the new Buddhist converts, who aren't real Buddhists. I do not mean to say that, and I don't want to be sued, but people who are ethnically, historically, culturally Buddhists as well. So you have huge numbers of people coming from various parts of Asia. And people become more aware of this. What happens after the Tina stage, where you see characters taking up Buddhism in small communities of sort of enlightened middle-class individuals, in the 70s, there is a large enough actual immigrant population to, of course, have the Asian cinema come to America and start to acquire a following there. And this mostly at this time is action movies, and a great deal of it is Bruce Lee, extremely prolific filmmaker. Are these Buddhist films? No. Although every film, almost every film, arguably, but in my experience, has moments where you refer to the virtues which the hero exemplifies and which the hero is seeking to maintain. And in the Bruce Lee films, they are different sets of virtues than what you see in American action films. But more importantly, the American audience is getting used to seeing action films in which Asians are the heroes. Now, the fact that it's a divide at this stage of two different film industries is important. America is not well integrated on the whole, and I think that's still the case with its Buddhist minorities. There have been many complaints from Buddhists, like quotes I won't go into, but quotes from eminent Tibetans, eminent Japanese Buddhists, who have complained deeply about American new Buddhists, and this is the phrase that's used, American converts' attitudes towards American ethnic Buddhists, is the phrase that's used in a lot of American Buddhist studies. You know, the new Buddhists are arrogant, their habit is to think they're superior to everyone else, they don't respect other races, other cultures, they are nationalistic. These are the quotes that you get. He says they're racist and patronizing. This is Tibetan Nyingma lineage, Norbu Rinpoche. I can't remember what year that was. So he's complained about this, and this is a great concern at that time. But you do have this historical fact of the hero tradition, the action movie tradition, being supplemented from the side. There's been an observation that this transformation of the hero idea in American action movies is double-sided. What you get later is heroes who go to the East. You look at, for instance, 7 years in Tibet, there's a lot of writing about the idea that the Westerner goes to the East to be saved, and then he saved so much that he's able to save the East. Because in the end, that's what the Westerner has to do. And that this is very much an Orientalist way that the West goes to the other country and appropriates the powers of superiority or the virtues of the other culture. I'm not absolutely sure about that, but that's very popular in colonial studies. And this particularly keys in with this later stage I've talked about, where suddenly, ethnographically, Buddhist cultures, and particularly Tibet, brings Buddhism to the fore. Because this is precisely the context where explicitly, for the first time, you have an ideology where everyone wants the wonderful spirituality of Tibet, and the Dalai Lama is becoming more and more of a media star, and so everyone is sort of moving in that direction, and lots of the Hollywood Buddhists and Buddhist sympathizers who've been quite influential arise at this time. That includes, of course, most famously Richard Gere, also Oliver Stone, Martin Scorsese, Harrison Ford, and his wife Melissa Ford were huge supporters of the Dalai Lama. Steven Seagal, hugely box office successful action hero who famously converted to Buddhism and decided he should stop making action films because it just wasn't really in keeping with Buddhist ethos. And he did, and then he got poor because he didn't have any more money from his action movies and he started again. But he'd always have a scene where he'd try not to kill people somewhere in the course of the film. And he'd sort of have some little peaceful speech that he'd make. Philip Glass, who interestingly did the music for a number of, he did the music for Kundun and a number of Buddhist-related films. Philip Glass is also a Buddhist. But, so that dynamic of Tibet raised lots of issues where we want what the East can give us, we want to save the East. It's a holiday that we take and then we come back. That's still the case. But it also reflects the idea that in the 80s, new dynamics are coming up, where, A, people are increasingly, for the first time, deeply dissatisfied with American culture as the existing order. All the films reflect. The 80s, of course, has the joy of American culture, but it very quickly starts to yield to highly critical films about escaping from the restrictions of the American dream, how the American dream has failed, and how the dream itself is actually fake, is not the reality, but a false reality, and you have to get through the false reality, be liberated from it, and reach what's on the other side. Of course, no one knows what's on the other side because some extraordinarily small percentage of Americans have passports and have ever gone to another country. So there's this liberation impulse, but also a certain unclarity about what will happen when you get to the other side. Also, in the 80s is prime time for people not going to church anymore and people questioning their religious affiliation. And this moves into the 90s where you have huge numbers of films where people talk about the awfulness of the 90s and the 80s. But also on the Buddhist side, more and more you get American Buddhist associations saying, well, you know, we give up. You don't have to be Buddhist. You can be sort of Buddhist. So I think I put the quote, the statement from the American Buddhist Congress, and I'll read the whole thing out just because it's a great little statement. The American Buddhist Congress cordially invites individual Buddhists and Buddhist organizations to join hands with us in promoting the interests of Buddhism in the United States and to work with us in our endeavor to develop an, quote-unquote, American Buddhism, which, while paying respect to Buddhist traditions of other cultures and acknowledging our debt of gratitude towards them, thank you so much, seeks to synthesize American values and traditions with the basic Buddhism of the Tripitaka without the linguistic and cultural trappings which are not understood or confusing to most Americans. And it's a fabulous little mini multicultural quote.
Is this written by Asian Buddhists?
I don't know whether it's written by Asian Buddhists or not. If you look up the American Buddhist Congress, it's on their website. And this is one of the first things that actually comes up if the average American type Googles American Buddhism. And just to finish that one, since Buddhism first came to the States more than a century ago, it's grown and flourished primarily among immigrants from the various Asian Buddhist traditions. We're committed to endeavoring also to reach the traditional European and African-American populations who have frequently been beyond the reach of Asian Buddhist traditions because of language and cultural barriers. We are convinced that Buddhism has an egalitarian, practical, and scientifically defensible appeal that will touch the hearts and minds of Americans of all traditions if we address them in English and in ways that are significant and meaningful to them. It's like a mini-manifesto of what assimilationist, transformed, quote-unquote, American Buddhist ideology will be. And I think it's important to recognize at this stage that you're not going to have a Buddhist, American Buddhist film industry. That was unlikely from the outset, but you can have Asian cinema, and what we have is mainstream that more and more reflects Buddhist ideas. So, with this, we're starting to enter a sort of postmodern world where the roots of the tradition is less important, and the idea of diversity and choice and appealing and combinations of cultural influences is quite important. Zoom ahead a bit because we're going to run out of time. So partly what I want to argue is that you start then to see, once we've gone through that spate of films in the 90s in which Nkundun, Little Buddha and 7 Years in Tibet, people have tried to educate you about Buddhism itself and mostly shown Westerners being involved in Buddhism, all Buddhists like the Dalai Lama getting interested in Western culture. Now what we do is we have a new phase in which Buddhist ideas are brought into mainstream films. And for me particularly, it's not just themes, but structures. So I've put down some of the themes that I think are the ones that are important in this case. The Great American Holiday is an early one where you go away, are transformed, and come back again. That's classic exoticism, Orientalism, the spiritual holiday and return. But that gives way. The empowerment and liberation of minorities comes out. The idea of American dream as a fake life. Heroism and being saved. So the hero now has to be saved himself. And that reality itself, it's not just that the American social dream is false, but that actually reality itself, this is the thoroughgoingness of postmodernism, at the social level, the individual level of your own psychology, but also deep within reality itself, things are not as they seem. Authenticity. This means that you have to go back to what is authentic. Very much also where the existentialist themes of independent cinema come in. And Americans looking for an atheistic spirituality. To me, this is one of the most important catalysts for American assimilation of what it sees as Buddhism. People have given up on God in many respects, certainly the theistic idea of God and all the structures that go with it, so very much theism attached to American society. And they're looking for spirituality that doesn't have to have this big father God featuring in it. That, I think, is very important. And I'll just show briefly a clip from the Truman Show. Peter Weir is a Hollywood director who very much is recognized as being concerned with films. So he made the films Witness, where Harrison Ford goes to an Amish community and has a very Zen-like experience and sees that their lifestyle is much better. He made the film Mosquito Coast, which explores a man who's discovered a new religious orientation. He made the Dead Poets Society. He made a film called Fearless, with Jeff Bridges, which is about a man who has a close encounter with death in a plane accident, and afterwards survives and believes that he can't be killed. And his encounter with death turns him into an existential hero who enlightens the lives of all around him, including a young Catholic woman whose child died in the airplane crash, which is also very much a film about what happens if you no longer fear death, if you no longer need the reassurance of a theistic religion, if you are then liberated from these structures. And in the film, the main character indeed thinks about leaving his wife and his child, hits the insurance man who comes to tell him he can get money out of the situation, and rejects the psychologist who comes to give him a careful psychoanalysis of his motives. All of these different things of American society are thrown away. Truman Show is good because it's a real postmodernist text.